Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Bravissimo.
Welcome and hello. That's Italian, isn't it? Bravissimo. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And since we've just passed the high holidays, there's been a lot of unknown universe out there. Take my word for that. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH.
Where?
That's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And this is the connection. They believe in the work we do, and so do I. And I applaud their efforts for doing this. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the nation.
When, why?
As a matter of fact, in my church just the other day, or it was yesterday, it's a general conference, and one of the main topics was about the family, how important the family is, a basic unit, and families are being beset on all sides. And a lot of the outcome, most of the outcome of this disenfranchised families is drug and alcohol addiction. And this is the basis of it. The platform of society really is the family. And until we have a program, I believe it has to be one-on-one to get the families cohesive again and a higher moral structure, it's going to continue to fragment and disintegrate it around the edges. And so is the morality of the nation, as well as the epidemic of drugs and alcohol. Harold?
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Joseph, for that introduction. It is true. It's amazing. The families that I see these days, parents are quite at a loss for what to do in so many situations because of the way they were parented, and so things are deteriorating. I'm not sure what will happen next. We just need to be able to teach some basic values, morals, and ethics, I believe, first to the parents, and then, of course, they can pass those along to the kids. But working directly with the kids is very difficult because, teachers often find this, that they're trying to work with the kids while they're at school, but once they go home, many of the things that they've learned are reversed. The parents are teaching all the time. They're teaching by example. And some of them don't set the best examples. They try to get by with the old adage, do as I say, not as I do. But that doesn't work because kids are going to, they're going to emulate their parents. They're going to copy the vocabulary and the behaviors that they see around them at home, no matter what. So, and I see so many young parents these days, and the main problem is drinking prescription pills that they're taking recreationally, as well as drugs, and especially meth and kush, the synthetic marijuana that's out there at the smoke shops, and there's so much psychosis, it's very difficult to tell the difference between someone on meth and someone who's having a psychotic breakdown. So that's what we're facing. say, I wanted to mention that we have a chat room. So if our listeners would like to, instead of calling in and talking, if they have a question for our interviewee tonight, they can go on and, let's see here, let me get it turned on. And what you do, folks, is go to rumradio.org, click at the top where it says Blog Talk Radio. Once you get to Blog Talk, click on the word live at the top, go down the right side, you can get on the chat room. So first go to rumradio.org, click on Blog Talk Radio, click on live, and look down the right side, you will be able to join us. So let me turn it back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. I was with my granddaughter Claire over the Saturday, and sweet girl, you know, grandchildren are the jewels in an old man's crown. And Claire, we were in a lot of traffic, and she said, "You know, Claire, this traffic is really bothering me." And she says, "You know, Grandpa, you know, Papa, I really like the traffic." I says, "Well, yeah, because you're not driving." I says, "Why do you like the traffic?" She says, "Because that gives us more time together."
Oh,
and that's sweet. Really, yeah. Yeah, where was I as a dad? I wasn't home as a dad, but I'm a good grandpa. Like to continue on? Yeah, well, you know, some get it quickly and some of us get it slowly. But, you know, you can do it quickly. I wish I would have did it quickly instead of slowly, but I was the slow variety. We'd like to start the show off with the third step prayer before I introduce our interview. The third step prayer is found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We do not represent AA. We don't represent NA, CA. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. Nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. This is independent. This is Rum Radio. We do use the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because all 12-step programs derive from that basic text and the understanding found therein. So it's the template. Now, of course, the 12 steps are the same in almost every group, almost verbatim, except for step one, which states the addictive substance or the problem. Other than that, folks, we're just about right there in the 12 steps. The 12 steps are the repentance process for children. This is a way we can get back into a higher spiritual plane. Step 12 tells us, having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps, the one result that we get from working all 12 steps is to get and attain a higher spiritual connection with God. That's it. That's as simple as it is. It's a simple program for complicated people. So when I get a sponsee, the first thing I'll ask them, and usually I'll wait until somebody gets their beginner's chip. And once they got that, I think they're ready to go. They've been humiliated enough in life, and they think we might have an answer. And I'll ask them after we circle up and say the prayer, grab them by the hand, and first question is, have you had enough? If he's had enough, he won't ask what that means. If he hasn't, usually he'll ask, what do you mean, have I had enough? Had you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough alcohol, i.e. drugs? Have you had enough? Yes or no? Yes. Okay. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. I tell them you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. I give them Clancy's 7 questions. I prepare it ahead of time when I'm looking. First thing I need you to do is answer these 7 questions. It's found on the website underneath the sponsorship tab. How to find the sponsee. Scroll down. You can print it out. It's in Word. I need you to answer these 7 questions. Doesn't matter how they answer them. The instruction is simple. I need you to answer these questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. It's not for everybody, but it works well with me. It's my personality. We're all different personalities, different people. But the big book on page 93 says, go find a prospect and start working on them. Should I repeat that, Harold? Go find a prospect and start working on them.
Yes, so this yes. Is, so important.
That's the instruction. It doesn't say have this prospect find you. That's nowhere in there. So I like to go by the big book. We find that to be the most comprehensive work in addiction recovery. Of course, NA has their own book. I've never read it. So I keep saying that. I need to read that. I heard it's a phenomenal book, and it's spiritually enlivened work, and I need to read that. But I know the big book works. It works if you work it. And then so once I get that the seven questions back, doesn't matter how we answered them. There's no grading involved. He took simple instruction and he followed through. He demonstrated that he was willing to go to a length. How long is a length? How long is a piece of string? We'll find out as we go along. So now I'm his temporary sponsor. All sponsorship is temporary, either temporary for a day or temporary for a lifetime or anywhere in between. And I tell him, okay, this is what I suggest you do. I don't tell him. I suggest. A suggestion is a subtle command. And I suggest to him, this book is meant to be suggestive, I suggest to him that he gets a home group. So he's connected up. And in that home group, to get the names of 20 or 30 men. I believe it works best, men with men, women with women. It's easier to relate to your own gender. One, two, sponsorship is an intimate relationship that can be easily misconstrued. And sex changes everything. But if you can't find someone of the same gender, you know what? You work the steps. Don't worry about it. But we find this to be the most productive. So you're going to call these 20 men. This is your lifeline. You get your phone numbers and ask permission to recite the third step prayer. And I have them do that for several reasons. One is to getting used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, they get to know the names of the people in their home group, and they get to know his name. So he's connecting up. Third, the third step prayer is also called a surrender prayer. But we'll try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, and possibly the fella he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink, taking his first hit of crack, or whatever the addiction might be. Chances are that spiritual environment will stop him from doing that and helping your sponsee get into service early. No guarantees, but I found this to be very productive in the work. And this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Well, I'd like to introduce our interview tonight, Daryl Tate from Oregon, right? You're in, Montana.
Montana, yeah.
You sound like you're from Texas. So, what part of Texas is that Montana in?
Dallas-Fort Worth was where I came from.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us. You're in the program now. Now, was it, you're in AA or CA, NA? What is it?
Well, kind of a mix of everything. I worked in a sober house in my early year in recovery, and I'm an alcoholic who has a pill addiction as well as a separation from God. So I go to the Celebrate Recovery. I've been to the NA. I go to the CASA meetings, the Christians Against Substance Abuse. And, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous was where I found my sobriety initially.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, we like to do – there's a format we use in the program called What Was Like – What happened, and what is it like now? And then we'll get into your passion of recovery. But what was it like? When did you realize you had a problem?
For me, I'm interrupting you. I'm having a little bit of trouble with this cell phone cutting in and out. We're getting rain here in Montana, so the signal's not all that great. But for me, I'm like a lot of alcoholics. I grew up with an alcoholic father, and I decided to start experimenting around when I was a young teenager. I stole my first beers out of his ice cooler and went out and did some drinking, started smoking the pot and taking the drugs and all those things that so many of us do.
And, how old were you?
When I started, I was probably 12, 13 years old. I was very, very young. My father was a very violent alcoholic, so I learned at a very young age that there was some benefit in being able to escape reality. My reality scared me to death and was also painful. So in order to escape that pain, I did what he seemed to be doing, tried the drinking, tried the drugs, tried various ways of getting away. And back in those days and in the beginning, it was a good way to escape. I did forget for a time what it was like to be at home with him. It continued to be a happy time for me, a good time for me to use drugs and to get drunk. They didn't turn around and bite me just yet in my early teen years. It wasn't until I was 28 years old and had been married for about 10 years that I finally decided that I needed to seek recovery. And
well, let me ask you this, Darryl. Now, did your father beat you? You were beaten pretty often, it sounded like.
Well, yes, and beating is kind of a... You know, I usually picture beating as a father punching a child or whatever, but I was one of those that we would get our belt whippings, and he would go from, you know, just a punishment and into a rage, and it became whelps and blood and those sorts of things, and he would just lose control. So, it was that and the... Just the mental abuse of it as well. A lot of times it didn't necessarily have to come to physical blows, just that he'd slide that belt off and start popping it in the other room, and that sent a message of its own. It would horrify you, terrify you as a child.
Sounds like we had the same dad.
My father, may have.
My father had a Garrison belt that had that ring to it. He'd snap it, and boy, I'd stand at attention, that's for sure. My brother, though, was interesting. My brother didn't get beaten. He was 8 years younger. I got physically beaten all the time. He got verbally abused. He was told how stupid he was. He would never amount to anything. And to this day, he would say that he would have rather been physically beaten than emotionally abused.
Well, and that's probably true. I have two sisters that are younger than I am, and I don't recall my father ever hitting them with that belt. He would make that threat, but I don't remember ever seeing him actually hit them. But later in life, as we began to suffer from the emotional scars of all those things, I saw both of my sisters suffer through much of the same types of pain that I went through myself.
How about school? You know, how'd you do in school? Did you have any problems in school?
You know, I'm a bright guy, and most alcoholics are. I didn't have a lot of trouble. My father died when I was 15 years old. He was the ripe old age of 40, had a massive heart attack. And that's when I decided that, you know, Mom used to say, you just wait till your father comes home. Well, when he wasn't coming home anymore, that's when I decided I didn't have to listen anymore. So that's when I quit school, dropped out, started getting real heavy into the drinking and the drugs and those kind of things. So, you know, just every type of disobedience I could find, I was going to get into once he was gone.
So did you help your mom, support your mom? Did you do any good stuff?
Absolutely not. My mother I resented for the longest time. You know, she was the one that left me in that situation. I blamed her for keeping me stuck in that place. I don't know what I expected her to have done, because she was, you know, as trapped as I was. But I did everything that I could not to help her. It was probably, you know, the loss of her husband was a horrible time for her, and that's been part of the amends that I've had to make in recovery was the way that I behaved in my youth. I'm sure I have a perfectly good excuse for it, but I don't really rely on excuses much anymore.
I see. So this is a fairly common story, but it's not common to you. This is very painful, I'm sure. And all right, so now you're in when did you leave home?
15 years old. It wasn't long after he died that I decided me and about four other guys split the rent on a two-bedroom party house. It was actually an apartment, and, you know, we all pitched in on the rent and spent our time working little tiny jobs and getting enough to get beer and drugs, and that was, we'd sell a little bit to support our drug habits, and that was what I did for the next 3 years. I got married early at 18 years old and got into a pretty decent relationship. I swore that I would never become what my father was. I would never abuse anybody. I would never become an alcoholic, never do all of those things. And it wasn't too long after I was married that I found out that I had become exactly what he was.
Yeah, I hear that. Let me do this, take a minute. I want to give out the call-in number if there's anybody out there that like to ask Daryl a question or you wanted to join in the conversation. The call-in number is 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. All right, Daryl.
You can go to rumradio.org and find the number there, and also find the chat. We have a chat open if you would like to ask a question, ask Daryl a question.
Yeah, so now you're married and you're fairly happy, you're working?
Yes, I was. I wanted to be the big successful guy, and compared to my friends, I was quite successful. I got a pretty good job and was making pretty good money. Sold a little bit of dope on the side to support my habits, and my wife and I were doing fairly well as a couple. We had a little at-home business that she ran out of the house, and I was a machinist, and, you know, just everything, all of life looked bright and shiny, and, I was ready to conquer it. And I did that for a few years. We began to fight, and I don't, you know, I'm 50-something years old. It's been a long time. It's been about 30 years since I was in that relationship, and I don't remember exactly what we fought about, just that we fought, and we fought quite a bit. I think both of us wanted control of things that were getting out of control. And, you know, I began to drink more and more. She was doing a little bit of drugs, but nothing to speak of. My life began to spiral downhill. And at the tender young age of 28, I found myself out in a field with a shotgun in my mouth and decided that the only solution that I could find at that point in my life was to end my life. I things were beginning to not work out for me. I was not happy in my marriage. I was not happy in my life. And I remember distinctly the police came. They kept me, you know, I don't think I ever intended to kill myself. I just wanted the attention of it. And the police came and drug me away. And I still remember vividly the cop coming by my cell, asking me if I realized what I had done and how much I had hurt that young lady. And I remember being angry with him for not feeling my pain. I was already feeling sorry for myself, but everything it seemed like was happening to me, not, I guess that's what my addiction always was everything always happening to me. And that's when I went into treatment for the first time, and attended my first AA meeting shortly after that.
So that was your bottom, the attempted suicide, although you, looking back at it now, it was more of a call for help, but you did have a shotgun in your mouth.
Well, that you would think that was my bottom. I wasn't quite done yet. I did get sober. I got sober through AA. I can look back and tell you exactly what I did not do right. I don't know exactly all the things I did wrong, but what I didn't do right, when I did my first, fourth, and fifth step, I thought, for one thing, my sponsor was fairly young and inexperienced, and today, looking back, I don't believe he knew exactly what he was looking for me to accomplish, but I thought it was just a time when I wrote down all of the adventures of my drunkenness. I didn't realize that I was supposed to be taking some kind of moral inventory, even though the step read that way. I thought it was just a time when I would sit down and talk about all the terrible things I'd done and feel like I was sorry and then move on. I never did bother to make amends with anybody, so I never really completed the steps. I managed to stay dry. I won't use the word sober, but dry for about 10 years. And then in order to really reach a bottom, I decided then that I could go ahead and control my drinking. I went and bought a little bitty tiny bottle of whiskey, and that turned into a half a gallon within a month. I didn't sober up again for 12 years, and at the ripe old age of 50.
Well, we find that, Darryl, and that's one of the reasons we put together Rum Radio. My experience with sponsorship is a lot of folks attempt at being a sponsor who haven't got a clue what a sponsor is supposed to do or not. Just shoot from the hip, and it worked for them. And the reason why it worked for you even for 10 years is because you wanted it that much. So it really doesn't matter what the sponsor does or doesn't do. It really matters, though, for the long term, one, and two, when you go to give it back, you don't have a clue what to do. So it's a perpetuating cycle of ignorance.
Yeah, and I agree with that. It's through no fault of the gentleman that originally sponsored me. I can't expect him to experience what he didn't experience, nor to share it with me. And it is all on me. I mean, I thought that working with others meant I had the solution. Let me tell you what to do. I'm afraid I see that pretty frequently these days. One thing that I would like to avoid is telling people what I think that they need to do. I will do that, but in addition to telling them what I think they need to do, I want to be able to live that. And I want to be able to tell somebody to do what I'm already doing. And my father was, the do as I say, not as I do kind of guy that you mentioned earlier. He was that. And I've decided in recovery that, you know, follow me, watch what I do. This is working for me. If you want what I have, then I'm happy to give you all the free information that I can.
All right, so you had your relapse after, what, 10 years? And we use dry. I usually say you might have been sober, but you're not in recovery. I mean, if you're not drinking and drugging, you're sober. I mean, I don't, you know, but we do call dry. You're dry. You're white-knuckling it. Not really working program. You're not growing spiritually. You're going to a lot of meetings. You go to a lot of meetings. You have to go to a lot of meetings. There's no way around it. If you're not going to the meetings, you're going to fall off really quick. I mean, but you have to, as long as you're going to a lot of meetings, chances are you can stay dry or you could stay sober, but you're not in recovery. So eventually what happens is you went out. Okay, now you went out. You're in a half a gallon within a month. Now what?
Well, and in addition to that, that still wasn't enough. I began to take hydrocodone, prescription drugs, and I took them just by the handfuls. I just stayed constantly in some sort of state that I don't even know how I lived through it. In fact, I almost didn't. But I spent 12 years that way, and you know, I had a party girlfriend. Her and I my wife and I had long since split up. We split up when I got out of recovery the first time because I had become such a saint. But, you know, her and I, we traveled around. My job required that I go from town to town. I was a door-to-door salesman, and it was easy money pretty much. I was pretty good at convincing people to do things that they weren't planning to do. I found that I had become very manipulative and very good at doing the things that alcoholics tend to do, get people to do what they need them to do in order to support their habits. And we traveled around, and I stayed in that state for a long time because I didn't want to stop long enough to actually let it soak in that I was miserable. And at some time during that process, I don't recall what it was, but the thought passed my mind as I was driving down the freeway that I could just swerve and hit that bridge pillar over there, and this would be over in a minute. And that thought bothered me enough that I called the hospital on myself and told them that what I told them was I thought that I was having a strange reaction to my medication, that I was having thoughts of suicide. But I ended up going to the hospital, and they've got a psych ward, and they put me in there for a few days, and that's when I had the that's when I made the decision that it was time to quit, and time to quit forever.
So that's your bottom.
So far it has been. I think it might stick. But, you know, I've relapsed once, so I don't ever want to say never, but I feel like I had a psychic change this time that I don't think I experienced the first time, and I don't see myself going back to giving up all this. I mean, and all of this means serenity, peace of mind, faith in a living, loving God that I actually see working in my life from one day to the next, which is a complete and total change for me. All my life it's been simply about me and what do I need and what can I get, and coming into recovery this time around, this has been all about what can I do for you today.
So now where did you go? Now where did you end up after? All right, you're out of the psych ward, you had your conscious contact, you've hit bottom, now you're ready to do this in earnest. Where do you end up?
Well, I'm standing looking out the window of the 10th floor of the John Peter Smith Hospital there in Fort Worth, and I'm watching as the world continues to go by even though I'm not in it. And that's when I had the epiphany that, you know, I'm not really that big a deal. I had been for months and months, waking up, or coming to, I should say, hours before I had to, with this feeling of dread in the pit of my stomach, that I had to get up and I had to do all these things. I had to go and get money to pay bills. I had to go and do all of these things. And as I stood there, I said to myself, you know what? What if I don't? The world seems to be doing just fine without me participating. That was the first time I actually questioned that voice in my head that kept telling me to go, go, go. And I promised myself once I got out of there that I would go and make those 90 meetings in 90 days. And in all honesty, I probably made 90 meetings in 25 or 30 days. I spent all my time at the AA hall in the beginning.
That's fairly common. I did just about the same. Sometimes 2-3 meetings a day, at least a meeting a day, at minimum. That was the minimum. First coming in, you don't know where else to go. So I get that. Where was this now? This was where?
It's 24-hour club. It was in it was just outside of Fort Worth, Texas, that I sobered up. And the 24-hour club, they actually weren't there 24 hours, but they had 5 meetings a day. And there were many, many days that I attended all 5 of those. I knew what I was looking for. And I had established at one time in my life a conscious contact with a God that I understood. He had revealed himself to me. I could... my God is the Christian God, and I could look at a Bible and understand what I was reading. It came alive for me. I had lost that, and when I got back into recovery, that's what I was looking for. It wasn't necessarily just to stop drinking and drugging. I wanted to find God, and I would literally be in tears asking people, how do you hear him? Where is he? I was struggling that hard to reconnect. And, what I tell people anymore is just it was that struggle that taught me to persevere. It was, if it had been any easier for me, I don't think I would have developed the faith and the trust that I actually ended up having. I left my wife. She was still wanting to drink, and the fact that I was attending meetings all the time was actually the topic of most of our arguments. I left her. I had to quit that job. There was a lot of lying involved in it, and I had just had this moral epiphany, so I couldn't possibly be that guy anymore. And ended up, fortunately, my sponsor, one of his other sponsees, managed a sober house there in town that agreed to let me come and start my life over. And by agreeing, I mean I had no money, so I walked in the door with only the promise that I would go find work and start paying my own way. And they were Sober by Grace Ministries was kind enough to open their doors to me and let me come in, and that's exactly what I did. I restarted my life. And it's been a pretty cool ride since then.
So it was called Sober by Grace Ministries.
That's correct.
I like that. That has I have a little ditty I say, we're saved by grace after all that we can do. Not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. So you've taken the action, and you all, if you noticed, it was all about action. All right, so you're in there now, and have you worked the steps again? Did you get the sponsor that was going to do what you needed to do the first time and wasn't able to?
I did. You were talking a little earlier about the questions you ask every prospect that you come across. He did the exact same thing, and I knew the answers just just like you described it. When he asked me if I was done, I said, oh, yeah. You know, I knew I was done. He asked me if I was willing to go to any length. And
no, do you mean no drinking no more? I said, yeah, that's it. No, I'm not ready yet. I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. You know, and I said, that's great. You know, keep coming to the meetings. I'm not the guy for you.
Right. No, I was not that guy. I can promise you that. I was beyond done. Being an alcoholic, you know, I guess a lot of times we start our lives over several times in the process of going downhill. You know, I moved to another town, everything's shiny and new and a new beginning and all that. I've done those things. This was not one of those times. This was everything in my life had stopped working. In fact, you know, I'm 50 years old at the time. Nothing was working for me. I had completely just given up on trying to find a solution myself. I knew in my own heart that I did not know the answer, and I knew in my heart that the only person, and I don't even think I should be calling God a person, but the only thing that would save me was a power greater than me, a power greater than anybody. And the sponsor I found, I knew within a meeting or two that he was my guy. He'd been sober for a pretty decent length of time, 7 or 8 years, was working the steps, knew his big book, and had been through, I think, and it wasn't an exaggeration, 30-some-odd treatment centers. In addition to being an alcoholic, he was a heroin addict. So newly sober, that seemed like my kind of guy, somebody who had overcome that much. I thought I was kind of special because I was older than a lot of than I had been the first time I came through, and I thought I was kind of special because I had suffered so much more. He put that thought to rest pretty quick.
Your terminal uniqueness was put to rest.
He drug out that big book, and we went to work. And yes, to answer your question, I completed the steps. I maintain those steps daily. My 10, 11, and 12 are important to me each and every day. I do not want to lose what it was so hard to get back, that connection, that conscious contact, and that communication. For so many weeks early in my recovery, I struggled to find a way to communicate with God. And today, 2.5 years after that, it's just that intuitive feeling. It's the there is a connection there that is as if we walk hand in hand, side by side through life. I appreciate that. I am grateful for that and so many other things in recovery, not the least of which is my health. I've had several little strokes, some heart problems, those kind of things that were made worse by the way I treated myself before. A lot of what I do today, besides the recovery from my drug addictions and alcoholism, is take a little bit better care of myself. Physically, I have a new attitude toward living. I just simply like it.
Yeah. Well, Zig Ziglar would say, if you don't think it's a great day, just try missing one.
Right on.
I'm coming to the age now where, I'm I'll be 66 in May next month, and you start considering your own demise. And when I'm laying in the coffin and people are passing by, you know what I wish they would say?
No, but
look, I think he moved. You were telling me early on that on this ministry that they also minister to some of the girls that are in the got involved in the white slave traffic, that got involved with drugs and then were used as money. You familiar with that at all? Yeah,
exactly. And I probably should. Sober by Grace was such a huge part of my recovery early on. They operate four sober houses right off of in Fort Worth, Texas. There's a road called East Lancaster, and it's a downtown Hooker Street of the Fort Worth area. Their sober houses happen to be right off of that road. So in addition to three men's houses, they had a woman's house as well for people that are coming off of drugs, alcohol, trying to start their lives over. And a lot of the women that we would get through there came straight off of East Lancaster. In fact, many times the girls that were in the house would be down on those streets ministering to the girls that were on those street corners. You know, a lot of times people think that they're just, they call them crack whores out there, and they're just there to get their next fix. But that's not as common as it seems. A lot of those girls are placed there by guys who have their own addiction problems, and they're forced into that place, forced into that behavior, either to support themselves or because they become addicted along with their pimp or whatever it is that you want to call these low lives that make them go out and prostitute themselves. But Sober by Grace was all about getting out on the street several times a month. They'll get out and take a lot of the houses. They want to promote giving back to the community. They want to promote some 12-step work, some thinking about others rather than yourself. And a lot of residents will make sack lunches and load up a couple of vehicles with 40 or 50 lunches, and a few nights a week during the month drive up and down the road handing them out to the homeless, talking to the prostitutes, talking to the homeless folks, talking to the alcoholics that have lost it all, and the drug addicts that are living on those streets, and offer them a meal at the very least, prayer if they want it, a place to stay if they're willing to make a few changes. So Sober by Grace is involved in a whole lot more than simply giving housing to a bunch of drunks.
Have you ever had a situation where the girls are trying to get off the street, they're trying to start a new way of life, but the pimps come back and grab them, and there's a physical altercations? Do you ever have any of that?
Yeah, that is way more common than you wish it was. A lot of times, and the sad part is these girls have a real hard time disconnecting from it. You get to where, you know, the big book talks about this becomes a way of life for us. It's the only normal life that we know. And you might take a girl away from that situation for a minute, but the street is right there. The temptation is right there. You know, sometimes they just want to go back, and they will take a beating in order to go back to get another high out of it. Once they get that addicted, they're willing to literally walk out the door of a house that would be there to save them. They would walk out the door, confront a man that they know is going to beat them for leaving, just to get high again. So we've had them, they used to come by the house trying to get their girls. There was more than a few times where, you know, I eventually worked my way into as a position as senior house manager. So I was kind of the guard dog over there, and there were more than a few times that I would end up having to confront guys that were there to get their girls, or in some cases, girls that were there to get their guys.
Really?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of folks can't really relate to that. They don't, you know, they don't get involved with that. I hate to tell you this, but my oldest daughter had a vacation, and she got tied up with a prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real tough pill for a father to swallow. Most folks don't realize that these girls are other men's daughters, wives, sisters. You know, they're just looking at them as commodities. But when it strikes that close to home, it's a whole different ball game. So did you had fights? You did have fights then.
Well, I'm not a big fighter. I'm a pretty big guy, and I'm pretty strong-willed. So a lot of times I can avoid the fights just by a simple confrontation and a battle of wills. And I had, you know, with four sober houses, there's 20-some-odd residents, and quite a few pretty big guys to for my backup. So they would get close, but we never. I think I was involved one time in an incident, and it was actually with a resident, not a guy off the streets.
It was interesting that sometimes the girls would come to get the guys. Is that it?
Well, that happened more than you would imagine. There, a lot of the folks that would show up in these recovery houses, there was a combination. It wasn't just alcoholics. There were a lot of meth addicts. There were a lot of heroin addicts. And most of them operate in some sort of a circle of friends, more or less, and you know, a lot of them were kind of like me with my girl and I running around the world, staying high and making money. A lot of the guys, when they decided to get clean and sober, left girls behind to fend for themselves. And these girls are pretty tough. I mean, they're streetwise, and you know, I don't envy any of the guys that actually had to stay away from them when those girls came a calling. They were pretty determined to take their men back and get their drug flow going again. So, yeah, it was unusual, but yeah, we would see a lot of the times that girls would show up to bring their man back home so he could go out and get their drugs and so forth.
Now, how did they finally, the ones that did finally sober up, was spirituality, the love of Jesus? What finally got them, in your opinion? What did you see?
You know, one of the biggest success stories, I'm just going to call her Mel and not add any more to it than that. She's still there. She doesn't live at on the property anymore, but she lives nearby, and she's very involved. And for her, it was a combination of 12-step big book something and Joyce Meyer's Ministries, and she's a meth addict. So, you know, it's an odd combination, but one that works for her. She's found a power greater than herself that works for her. It is the Christian God, the same Christian God that I found, and the same Christian God that Sober by Grace Ministries is all about. In combination with the 12 steps and how to balance those things out together, you know, it's we didn't become street preachers. And, you know, street preachers, to me, I'm sure they fill their own niche, but I'm not that guy. I'm a guy that just has a pretty good definition and a pretty good understanding of who my higher power is and what it means to have a personal relationship. And she found that same kind of thing. And I think the secret to to my recovery has been just that. I went in digging for a personal relationship with a higher power, and I found it. And I think the reason it's such an important part is because I think very little about myself. You know, I started off early in recovery working with others. You're affiliated with an online page called The Rowdy Rum. I created one called One Day at a Time when I was about 4 months sober. So I began to give back early to the recovery community, and I'm pretty involved in that community, both online and outside in the non-electronic world. And I think that giving back is all about what my higher power is about. It's about what can I do for him. Step three tells me to turn my will and my life over to his care. And I took that literally. I took it seriously. I took it to mean it's no longer what I want to do. If I want to live, if I want to survive, I'm going to have to quit being so selfish and so self-centered, and I'm going to have to seek God's will for my life, and I'm going to have to look for what I can do to help you find what I've found. And it's not just sobriety that I found. It is that connection with a higher power. It is telling people this is about your service to your community. 50 years I took from my community. It's time to give back. And I try my best to do that. I'm involved in my local AA group. I have a church family here where I attend Celebrate Recovery meetings in addition to AA. And I'm on the list at we have one local hospital, and I'm on the list that the pastor up there has to give me a call if he runs across a detoxing drunk who seems to want to find a solution.
Well, that's great, Daryl. Harold also goes to Celebrate. Harold?
Yes, we spoke about that a little bit earlier this afternoon, and I really value the lessons in Celebrate Recovery for two reasons. One is that Jesus Christ is at the middle of it. The other is that they've gone back to 1935 and put the steps and the scriptures back together as they originally were. AA was going to be called the James Group because a lot of the steps come from the book of James. Other steps come from the book of Matthew, chapter 5, Sermon on the Mount. So I really value that. And so what I found is that Rick Warren and John Baker and the publishing team have put together the four books of recovery for Celebrate Recovery into one paperback book, sell it at a discount just for folks taking those into the jails. And so we go to Fort Bend County Jail weekly, and the guys are really grateful for the folks that come in and teach that. And so that's one of the ways that I show my appreciation to the Lord Jesus Christ. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Well, thank you, Daryl. It's been really informative. I've learned a lot from you. That was very interesting. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing that with us.
Joseph, I appreciate very much you having me and giving me the opportunity to share a portion of my story and to let the world know that I thank God and thank Alcoholics Anonymous and the Celebrate Recovery folks out there, all of those for helping me to find the solution to the problems that I was having.
Thank you. In closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,700 plus towns, cities, and villages, and we're approaching or probably past now 300,000 hits to the website. We're averaging about 1,000, 1,100 hits a day. So it's helping a lot of folks. The only people who don't like Rum Radio are people who don't like anything they've never tried. If you look at it, you'll like it. It's all programmed. It's basic recovery with the big book and the 12 and 12, and we answer questions in sponsorship, one of the least addressed areas of recovery, and it's probably the most important area of recovery. One drunk talking to another drunk about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the most powerful tool we still have, and that's what we do on Rum Radio, is to give you those tools, some extra tools. You have a good program right now, that's great, but you can always use another tool. My dad was a mechanic for 30 years. He loved another box of tools. If he'd never even used the tool, he wanted to know the tool was there if he ever needed one. So go to rumradio.org for any of your questions. Thanks, guys, for your time. Thanks to you listeners. I hope you got something out of it. I surely did. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Joseph.